My name is Eric Werland, and I represent the organizers of this very special event. I'm very pleased to see you all, and it's a great privilege that Noam Chomsky has agreed to come to Utrecht and deliver a lecture to our students on responsibility and integrity, the dilemmas we face. The primary goal of our humanities lecture series is to motivate our students to look beyond their disciplines, become aware of broader connections, and to enable them to play the role in society that our society needs, to be able to distinguish what's going on under, behind the surface. This crucial awareness is what we as organizers are convinced Noam Chomsky's lecture will help to develop, an awareness of what is hidden beyond the facades of institutional newspeak. And that's why we're here together.
What does a brain of a dean of humanities look like when it's asked to introduce Noam Chomsky? When Eric Roland asked me, I thought, this is a chance of a lifetime, and immediately called my colleague at the medical center. With an ambulance, they took me to the 7 Tesla and started the MRI procedure. Clearly, we could see that there were several functions in the brain activated at different stages. First of all, the large area of proudness in the left part lightened up. Years later, this dean would be able to say to everyone in the nursing home, time and again, I introduced Noam Chomsky. The only thing the dean hoped for was that by then the nurses would be so kind to believe him. Then the brain activity moved to the right part, near the area of despair. Introducing Noam Chomsky was a hopeless and even impossible enterprise. Anything that would come out of the dean's mouth would be hopelessly irrelevant for everybody in the audience, since everyone knew who he was. Proof, even before eating the pudding, was that it took only 2 seconds before all seats for this event were sold. Close to this area, the small spot of hope flared up. Yes, maybe there was one listener who did not know who Chomsky was. The dean would design his speech exclusively for that one lost, poor, and wandering soul. As the scan proceeded, the dean started designing his academic and therefore familiar introduction. He would give the audience the titles of the books Noam Chomsky had written. For that's what all scholars do with someone who needs to be introduced. First, they name the title, then they give a short description of the content, and finally, they give a brief overview of the impact the books had made. Lying in the 7 Tesla, the dean took his cell phone and called Eric. How much time did he have for his introduction? 5 minutes, Eric replied. But I need at least 5 hours, the dean cried out. Noam Chomsky has published 105 books between 1957, when syntactic structure saw the light, and October last year, 2010, when Gaza in Crisis appeared. So 1 hour for reading the titles, and the second hour for giving a description of the content, not only linguistics, but also philosophy, like Power and Ideology from 1987, or the Chomsky-Foucault debate from 2006. But not only philosophy, but also political theory, like American Power and the New Mandarins from 1969, to failed states, the abuse of power, and the assault on democracy from 2006. And the other 3 hours the dean needed for discussing the impact. He would have to limit himself to only a tiny part of this world, the Netherlands, Europe, the United States, and the Middle East. When the scan was finished, the dean walked out of the hospital like a new man. His brains felt clear and totally blank, like fresh fallen snow. He knew the opening line of his introductory speech. He would say, "Dear Professor Chomsky, that was the idea." And then he would read a poem by one of his most beloved poets, Mark Strand. It was called "The Idea." For us too, there was a wish to possess something beyond the world we knew, beyond ourselves, beyond our power to imagine, something nevertheless in which we might see ourselves. And this desire came always in passing, in waning light, and in such cold that ice on the valleys, lakes cracked and rolled, and blowing snow covered what earth we saw. And scenes from the past, when they surfaced again, looked not as they had, but ghostly and white, among false curves and hidden erasures. And never once did we feel we were close, until the night wind said, "Why do this? Especially now, go back to the place you belong." And there appeared, with its windows glowing, small, in the distance, in the frozen reaches, a cabin. And we stood before it, amazed at its being there, and would have gone forward and opened the door and stepped into the glow and warmed ourselves there, but that it was ours by not being ours and should remain empty. That was the idea. Professor Chomsky, welcome.
Not used to such eloquent introductions. That makes it a hard act to follow. The term intellectuals in the modern sense, in the sense in which we now use it, pretty much came into a conventional usage with the Dreyfusards in the late 19th century. And they're now very much honored for their courage in standing up for justice and human rights. However, it's worth remembering that the Dreyfusards were a small minority. The great mass of intellectuals in France and elsewhere supported the state. And that's pretty typical. In fact, that helps us distinguish two interpretations of the common phrase, responsibility of intellectuals. One interpretation has to do with the functions, the tasks, the role that they actually fulfill, question of fact. Another is a question of value, what role should they fulfill? It would be nice to say that the answer to these two questions is the same, but in fact, what the rather typical situation is what, in fact, was illustrated by the Dreyfusard example. If you go a few years beyond into the early years of the last century, World War I, the intellectual classes on all sides passionately supported their own states in the First World War. There were a few exceptions, as there always are, in England, Bertrand Russell, and Germany, Rosa Luxemburg, and Karl Liebknecht, in the United States, Eugene Debs. They all ended up in jail, which reflects another aspect of intellectual life. Those who depart from the assigned task, support for power, framing of issues to provide justifications for power, they usually suffer in one way or another. How they suffer depends on the character of the state, but it's pretty common. So, for example, in the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union, in the post-Stalin era, the intellectuals we call dissidents were treated pretty badly. For example, in Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel was jailed, house arrest, insulted, condemned. Similarly, in the other countries of Eastern Europe, sometimes worse, but that was the typical situation. Well, that was bad, but it could have been worse. So, for example, Havel and his associates could have had their brains blown out by elite Czech forces fresh from training in the Soviet Union, who already had tens of thousands of bloodied victims to their credit. But that's not invented. That's what happened in exactly the same time in U.S. domains. That happened to be in El Salvador. 1 week after the fall of the Berlin Wall, an elite unit of the Salvadoran army, fresh from training at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School in North Carolina, on the explicit orders of the government and the high command, which have since surfaced, broke into the university, Jesuit University, killed the rector, six leading Jesuit intellectuals, major figures in Latin American intellectual life, blew their brains out, killed their housekeeper and daughter because the orders were not to leave any victims, and then escaped. This battalion had already had a bloody roll of victims in the preceding 10 years. There were 10 years of major atrocities, beginning with the assassination of an archbishop reading mass, called the Voice for the Voiceless, Archbishop Romero, and plenty of religious martyrs in between, plenty of intellectuals attacked and killed in between. Many escaped to Nicaragua, which in the 1980s was kind of like Paris in the 1930s, the place where people escaped from the terror states surrounding them. Then it was Stalinist Russia, Nazi Germany in the 1980s. It was the various terror states that the U.S. was funding, supporting, and participating in their crimes. What happened in El Salvador was bad enough. It was about 70,000 killed, almost entirely the government-related security forces funded by the U.S., trained and armed by them. But the other countries were even worse. Guatemala was about 100,000, and Nicaragua maybe 30,000. Altogether, about 200,000 people killed in the 1980s. That was called a war on terror. Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981 and declared that the core function of U.S. foreign policy would be to combat the plague of the modern age, return to barbarism in our time, namely state-supported international terrorism. That episode has kind of been disappeared from history, to borrow the Latin American transitive verb, disappear. It's been eliminated. Kind of wrong story, wrong agency, not the right kind of thing to remember. It goes back much before that. This war on the murder of the Jesuit intellectuals in 1989 terminated a long campaign of terror and brutality that started in the early 1960s. It started actually with Vatican II. Vatican II in 1962 was an attempt by the Pope, Pope John the 23rd, to institute a really radical change in church history. As you probably know, he tried to restore the church of early Christianity, the Gospels, what they actually say, a message of radical pacifism, which is, of course, why the early Christians were persecuted. That changed in the 4th century when the Roman Empire took over the church, made it the church of the persecutors, not the church of the persecuted, in the phrase of distinguished theologian Hans Küng, one of those punished in the period of the 60s and 70s. He wasn't killed. He was just kind of kept from teaching and so on. He is lucky. In 1962, at Vatican II, the Pope declared an effort to return the Church to its original mission, to be the Church of the persecuted, a very significant change. And it was taken seriously, particularly in Latin America. The Latin American bishops adopted that program. They adopted what was called the preferential option for the poor, message comes out of the Gospels, and priests and nuns, laypersons, went to the countryside, tried to organize peasants into base communities where they would read the Gospels, think about ways to adopt measures to survive somehow in the extremely harsh domains of U.S. power. Now, that was a heresy that was not going to be tolerated. The U.S. very quickly launched a war against the church. The church and all social movements that were participating in these similar efforts. It began very quickly in 1964. A military coup took place in Brazil, overthrowing the civilian government that had actually been prepared by the Kennedy administration, carried out shortly after Kennedy's assassination. That established what was called a national security state, kind of a neo-Nazi style terror and torture state. Brazil's a big country, a big influence. A plague spread through the hemisphere. Chile, Uruguay, Argentina, one country after another, similar phenomena, plenty of religious martyrs because they were in the forefront. And it continued through Central America in the 1980s. It essentially terminated with the murder of the six Jesuit intellectuals in November 1989, right at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, it's well known to scholarship that the terror and atrocities and brutality and slaughter in Latin America from 1960 to the end of the century were incomparably worse than anything that happened in Eastern Europe in those years. What happened in Eastern Europe is bad enough, but what went on in Western domains was incomparably worse. Now, that's known to scholarship. For example, you can read it in the recently published at Cambridge University History of the Cold War, kind of comment on it. But it's not known to the public. What's known to the public is the suffering of the East European dissidents, which was real, and they should be respected and honored. But in comparison with what was happening elsewhere, they were pretty lucky. Far luckier than the Jesuits of El Salvador or the Archbishop or many others during those years. Well, the task of intellectuals is to ensure that we know about the East European dissidents, and we pride ourselves on our heroism in supporting them, but we don't know about the ones who we slaughtered and tortured and killed. That's out of history, not to be remembered. I happened to be in Europe in November 2009 at the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and there was a great deal of euphoria, self-congratulation about our great courage in supporting dissidents in the enemy's domain. But there wasn't a word about what happened in Latin America, primarily carried out by the United States, but with the strong support of its European allies all the way through. Well, that's the typical task of the intellectuals. If you go back to, say, the Vietnam War, there was protest, substantial protest, mostly on the part of young people, students, people outside the elite intellectual circles. There was some protest there, but very muted and quite interesting in its character. I've written about it if you want the details. Up through the early years of the war, there was overwhelmingly strong support for the war, virtually no protest. In fact, support for the war was so strong that very few people, even today, know when the war began. It actually began just 50 years ago, in 1961. Kennedy, President Kennedy at the time, sent the American Air Force to start bombing South Vietnam, authorized the use of napalm, chemical warfare to destroy crops and ground cover, programs to drive the rural population, which was overwhelmingly supportive of the guerrillas, as they knew, to drive them into what amounted to concentration camps called strategic hamlets, to surround them with barbed wire to protect them from the guerrillas who they were strongly supporting. It ended up with millions of people being driven out. I don't have to describe what happened to South Vietnam was virtually destroyed. The war expanded to the rest of the of Indochina, always with European support and with virtually no criticism. About 1966 or 67, there were few voices of criticism in educated circles on the grounds that it was not working very well. Same kind of grounds you hear today in Afghanistan, or you heard a couple of years ago about Iraq. It wasn't working too well, you know, maybe it was a mistake. In 1968, everything changed. In January 1968, there was an amazing uprising in South Vietnam. There's been nothing like it in history. The country was saturated with over 500,000 American troops, over 100,000 Thai, Korean, other mercenaries, a huge army, you know, 700,000 or 800,000 people, every village penetrated, informants everywhere. All of a sudden, in January 1968, there was an uprising which no one knew about. Everyone had kept quiet, and it was all over the country, practically. You know, I went, broke into the American embassy, you know, this is the Tet Offensive. I don't think there's ever been a case of such overwhelming commitment to a revolutionary cause. No one even talked about it, and it was a surprise everywhere. Well, that struck a chord with the American business community, the ones who are decisive in determining policy. It got them to recognize that this war isn't worth fighting any longer. We've basically won our objectives. It's a waste of money and time. And they pressured the government, a pretty strong power play, to reverse policy. And the government did follow orders, reversed policy, started withdrawing troops, entered in negotiations. The president announced that he's not going to run for a second term, and so on. The intellectuals responded almost reflexively. All of a sudden, everybody became a long-term opponent of the war without any trace that anyone can find. In fact, the record says the opposite. But that was the new party line. We're long-term opponents of the war, got to get out, was a mistake, shouldn't have gotten in, and so on. There are a number of leading figures in the Kennedy administration who wrote memoirs. Arthur Schlesinger, Roger Hilsman, Theodore Sorensen, others, they rewrote their memoirs, literally. The early memoirs, the ones written at the time, if you look at them, were fully supportive of the war, or often didn't even mention it because it was so uninteresting. The post-1968 story, which is the one that enters into history, is Kennedy was going to pull out of Vietnam. Everybody was opposed. You know, should never gotten in the first place. It's the bad Texan, Lyndon Johnson, who turned everything around. and we, the intellectuals, were passionate opponents of the war. We couldn't make our case. That's the more or less official story today. If you go to 1975, when the war officially ended, it's quite interesting to look at what was being written then and what popular attitudes were then. At that time, among the public, about 70% of the population in polls said that the war was not a mistake. It was fundamentally wrong and immoral. That's 70% of the population. Not a phrase like that in the educated community. In fact, at the outside limits of criticism, say in the New York Times, the most dissident journalist, Anthony Lewis, wrote that the war began with blundering efforts to do good. Efforts to do good is tautological. The U.S. government was carrying it out, so it was efforts to do good. Blundering, yeah, it didn't work. So it began with blundering efforts to do good, but by 1969, that's after the Tet Offensive, it had become clear that the war was a mistake and that we could not achieve our, by definition, noble objectives at a cost acceptable to ourselves. So it was really a mistake. That's the critical end of elite educated dissident opinion at a time when 70% of the population said, no, it's not a mistake, it's fundamentally wrong and immoral. Those are phrases that don't appear in educated discourse, wrong and immoral. Maybe wrong because it didn't work, but not immoral. And that's very typical. Take a look at current debate about, say, Iraq. At the outer limits of criticism within the educated mainstream, you have, for example, Barack Obama, who is very strongly praised and honored for his principled opposition to the war. What was his principled opposition? He said it's a strategic blunder. We're not going to be able to do it at a cost acceptable to ourselves. That's kind of like Nazi generals after Stalingrad. After Stalingrad, I'm sure there was criticism in the German general staff of Hitler's blunders. And why fight a two-front war when you should have knocked out England first and then gone ahead? So, yeah, it was a strategic blunder. We don't call that principled criticism. I don't have records from the German general staff, but we do have records from the Soviet Union. If you read Pravda in the mid-1980s, that's the way they described the war in Afghanistan. It was a strategic blunder. Should never have gotten into it. Again, we don't call that principled criticism. We don't honor and respect them for that stand. But when it's done on our side, that's exactly what we do. Well, could go on and on about this, but this is the task of the intellectuals, overwhelmingly, and the task that they fulfill. Focus on the crimes of enemies, the fate of the dissidents in Eastern Europe, suppress totally your own crimes, even if they're incomparably worse, as they were in the same years in Latin America, for example, case after case is like this, and ensure that uncomfortable information doesn't bother the general public. So take, say, Holland right now. As you know, I'm sure, a couple of days ago, a trial ended in The Hague, the trial of Charles Taylor for terrible crimes in Sierra Leone. The case was narrower than what the prosecutors wanted. The prosecutors, who were, one of them is a distinguished law professor in the United States, the other a well-known barrister in London, they wanted a much broader case. They had collected, they claim, massive evidence to implicate Gaddafi in the crime. He'd been massively funding Taylor, participating, sending arms. So they wanted to broaden the case to include Gaddafi. Well, the U.S. and Britain blocked it. And the International Criminal Court, of course, takes orders from the masters. So they narrowed the case, and no mention of Gaddafi, and I don't read the Dutch press, but you can tell me how much reporting there was about this. I'll be willing to make a wager. That's happening right at this minute, and it's the normal pattern. The wrong kind of story must be marginalized and kept from the eyes of the public, and meanwhile we focus on the terrible crimes of others, like Charles Taylor in Sierra Leone. I mean, it's pretty obvious why they wanted to cut Gaddafi out. He was a loyal friend and ally, so you don't want to implicate him. Well, now the story's changed, so you know, we talk about what we can do about this monster. That's, again, perfectly normal. To take just one last case, in the 1970s, Saddam Hussein was an enemy. That changed in the early 80s. In fact, in 1982, the Reagan administration decided that they wanted to provide arms to Iraq, to assist in their invasion of Iran. Well, there's a little impediment. There's an institution called the List of Terrorist States, and Iraq was on the list of terrorist states. So the government had to remove Saddam from the list of terrorist states, and since there was a gap, they had to put somebody in, so they put Cuba in honor of the fact that Cuba had been the victim of really massive terrorism in the preceding several years, shooting down an airliner, killing 75 people, blowing up embassies, all sorts of crimes. So they were put in on the terrorist list to replace Saddam, who came out. The next year, 1983, we had Donald Rumsfeld going to Baghdad, you know, shaking hands with his friend Saddam, entering into arms and other deals. This continued right through the 1980s. U.S. support for Iraq was so strong that Iraq was given a kind of a gift that no other country has except Israel. They were permitted to attack a U.S. ship and kill a couple of dozen sailors and get away with it nothing but a weak apology. Nobody can do that except for Israel, which did it in 1967. But that shows real love. The U.S. essentially entered the war. The U.S. also denied Saddam's atrocities. That's the Halabja massacre, the Al Anfal massacres of the Kurds, everything denied. In fact, the administration even intervened in Congress to prevent them from issuing a declaration of censure for these huge atrocities, the worst ones of Saddam's rule. And finally, the U.S. entered the war directly, and Iran capitulated. They couldn't face U.S. Participation in the war. Love for Saddam continued after the war. In 1989, so that's a year after the war ended, the president was now President Bush, the first President Bush. He invited Iraqi nuclear engineers to the United States for advanced weapons training in nuclear weapons manufacture. That's 1989. A couple of months after that, President Bush sent a delegation to Iraq to convey his greetings to his friend Saddam. This was April 1990. The delegation was led by Senator Robert Dole. He was Senate Majority Leader, later Republican presidential candidate, other high-level senators. We have the transcript. They brought President Bush's greetings to Saddam. They assured Saddam that he could ignore some critical comment he was hearing in the American press, that we have this freedom of press business, so we can't figure out a way to shut them up, but you can ignore them. And in fact, the White House assured Saddam that they would remove from them the Voice of America, you know, the official international press service, eliminate a reporter who was being too critical of their friend. This was April 1990. A couple of months later, Saddam committed a real crime. He disobeyed orders, or maybe misunderstood them. It's not clear. And he invaded Kuwait. Okay. He suddenly became the reincarnation of Hitler. Saddam realized when he invaded Kuwait that he'd made a mistake, that he thought it could be authorized. He didn't understand. He saw right away he's in trouble. And then the discourse in the White House is interesting, which we also have. In the White House, they were concerned. Colin Powell, head of the Joint Chiefs, said, the problem is that Saddam might withdraw and leave a puppet regime behind, and all the Arab states would be perfectly happy. And we can't allow that to happen, so we have to go to war and destroy Iraq. Well, if Saddam had been allowed to do that, he would have duplicated almost exactly what the U.S. had done a couple of months earlier, namely invaded Panama in order to kidnap a thug who had also disobeyed orders, brought him to Florida where he was tried for crimes that he committed while he was on the CIA payroll, installed a puppet government. About the only difference is the Latin American states weren't happy about it. They threw Panama out of the coalition of democratic states and so on. The deaths were also a little different. According to Human Rights Watch, tried to estimate it, when Saddam invaded Kuwait, there were about 800 people killed. According to Panamanian human rights groups, when the U.S. invaded Panama, there were about 3,000 killed. Now, we don't look at casualties that we cause. That's another thing that's off the record. So there's no Western confirmation of these calculations, but they could very well be right. American forces were bombing apartment houses and poor neighborhoods and so on. Well, that's not exactly the story the way it reaches us. It's only the story the way it happened all the way through. And that's, again, quite typical. It's like not mentioning the slightly embarrassing fact that the International Criminal Court absolved Gaddafi of the atrocities for which they just condemned Taylor, because he was a friend and an ally, like Saddam Hussein. This story just proliferates so far that it's almost pointless to give examples. It's hard to think of an exception. It's close to uniform. And that tells you something very significant about the role of intellectuals and their responsibility in the service of power, both in supporting atrocities and crimes and in reshaping the current scene and history so that it looks good for us, you know, for the powerful. This may be against the will of the public, as in the case of Vietnam, but it ends up being the picture that's transmitted to later generations. So it's what you read in school and so on. I said that the Dreyfusards were that's when the term intellectual came into common use. There were intellectuals before the Dreyfusards. They weren't called that. They were called something else. And it goes back to the origins of recorded history. So you go back to, say, classical Greece. There was a man who was made to drink the hemlock, the death sentence, because he committed a crime. He was corrupting the youth of Athens by challenging false gods. And that's a crime. So get rid of him. He was a dissident and treated the way dissidents are treated. Roughly the same time, from the biblical records, we discover that there were dissidents. Again, they weren't called that. They weren't called intellectuals. They were called prophets. That's a bad translation of a very obscure Hebrew word. Nobody knows what it means. But they were called prophets. But if you look back at, if you read the Bible, what they were was what we would call dissident intellectuals. They were carrying out geopolitical analysis, warning that the kings were, you know, carrying out actions like alienating the Assyrians and so on, which were going to cause disaster. They were calling for mercy and justice to widows and orphans. They were condemning the crimes of the evil King and so on, were they treated nicely? Well, you know, go back to the Bible and take a look. They were called the haters of Israel. That's the origin of the phrase self-hating Jew, which you hear all the time. It extends to anti-American, you know, meaning critics of your own country. They were driven into the desert, you know, imprisoned, I mean, not treated nicely at all. There were intellectuals who were treated very well and honored. They were also called prophets. Centuries later, they were called false prophets. But they were the flatterers at the court, and they were doing fine. And that's the way it works. Flatterers at the court are honored and respected. The critics are punished one way or another. How they're punished depends on the society, but always treated badly in one way or another. It can be at the extreme. It can be like the assassinated Jesuits. Lesser punishment could be, say, Havel and Sakharov, and similarly all the way back. Now, this is a very persistent theme in history. You can think it through and see if you can find counterexamples. Actually, there are a few counterexamples, and they're very striking. So today, in today's world, the only really significant counterexamples that I know of, at least, are in Turkey. Leading intellectuals, the prominent writers, the most prominent writers, academics, journalists, publishers, and artists, not only are protesting constantly the crimes of the Turkish state, which are pretty serious, not only protesting those crimes, but constantly participating in civil disobedience against them, which means facing, sometimes enduring, really severe punishment, like long jail sentences. I don't have any other country like this. And I have to say, when I come to Europe, I always have to smile a little when I hear that the Turks are not civilized enough to be allowed into the august European Union. I mean, maybe, but from another point of view, it looks a little bit different. But that's the only major exception that I know today. So there are exceptions, undoubtedly. Well, that's one interpretation of the responsibility of intellectuals. What's the general task that they fulfill, the factual side? There's also the value issue. There you have to, factual side, you can study the facts and draw pretty conclusions with fair confidence. When you turn to the values, of course, you're asking what your own moral values are. And I think there are a number of pretty simple ideas that ought to define what the role of intellectuals ought to be. By intellectuals, I just mean people of relative privilege, training, resources, opportunity, an ability to be in a position where you can get involved in some fashion in affairs that matter to human beings. So it's intellectuals. It excludes, for example, a great scientist who just stays in his laboratory and, you know, wins his Nobel Prize. It excludes somebody who's working so hard putting food on the table that he just doesn't have time to think about these things. But it includes, in our societies like ours, a large group of other people, for example, anybody related to a university anyhow, because we have these privileges and opportunities. So that's roughly the category. One principle that you'd think would be obvious is that we apply to ourselves the same standards we apply to others, or maybe harsher ones, more stringent ones, but at least the same ones. So if terror is bad when they do it to us, then terror is bad when we do it to them, maybe 10 times as much. And that's, again, to take a historical example, if anyone were to follow this principle, take, say, 9/11, you know, the great modern event that changed the world, transformed the world. It was a terrible atrocity, undoubtedly, could have been a lot worse. Very much like Havel's punishment could have been worse. So suppose on 9/11 that Al-Qaeda had, say, bombed the White House, killed the president, installed a military dictatorship, murdered thousands of people, tortured tens of thousands of people, established an international terror center in Washington, which started overthrowing governments in other countries and installing comparable dictatorships, carrying out assassinations abroad and so on, brought in a group of economists, you know, maybe call them the Kandahar boys, who quickly tanked the economy, drove it into the worst depression it had been in maybe in its entire history. Okay, that would have been worse. It happened on 9/11. It happened on 9/11, 1973. It's the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile and the installation of the Pinochet dictatorship. Well, it was a lot worse. In fact, in Latin America, they often call it the first 9/11. It was incomparably worse than what we call 9/11 by any dimension you can think of. But that one, and it certainly changed the world. It was instrumental in causing the rash of dictatorships that spread over Latin America and much else, not to speak of what it did to the people of Chile. But that's not in history. If we were to accept the elementary principle that the usual defect, wrong agency, U.S. was behind it, if we were to accept the principle that we apply to ourselves the same standards we do to others, that's the way we'd be discussing and teaching and thinking about the atrocities of 9/11. Well, needless to say, it's not, though it is in parts of South America. The victims tend to have a somewhat more realistic view of the world than the ones who hold the clubs. So one principle is at least apply to yourselves the same standards you do to apply to others. It sounds simple, but almost never observed. Another is to set priorities. You know, we all have finite energy and time, can't do everything. So try to focus on the things that are important. What are importance, of course, is another value judgment. So what's important? Well, one criterion for importance is things that you can influence. So if there's something going on somewhere where you can have an influence, well, that's important to focus on. Maybe nice to criticize the crimes of Genghis Khan, but you can't do much about it. And the same is true of crimes carried out by somebody else. You know, you can say how awful it is, but nothing much you can do. On the other hand, crimes in which you're involved yourselves, you can do quite a lot. The closer you are to agency, the more you can do. So that should be the focus. Well, I won't run through examples. I leave it as an exercise. But you'll find that exactly the opposite is done. Exactly the opposite. In fact, you can pretty well determine what the role of intellectuals ought to be by taking a look at what is going on and just turning it to the opposite. It comes out, turns out to be a pretty successful technique of analysis. So that's another thing you can do. Other things you can do are to participate in changing your own surroundings, you know, as much of the society as you can reach, in such ways that these values will be accepted, whether it's by teaching, by organizing, by activism, many other ways. I just end by citing an injunction by which often is used to formulate these principles, which I think merits some critical attention. It's a precept used by people who personally are close friends and who I respect and honor a lot, a Quaker activist, a Quaker human rights anti-war activist, very courageous people, also involved in civil disobedience, protests, very dedicated, picking the right principles. Their precept is that they should be telling truth to power. And I think that's the one thing I really disagree with them on. I don't think that the role of people with some degree of privilege, say like us, should be to tell truth to power. One reason is power already knows the truth. You don't have to tell it to them. They understand it very well. That's why they're doing what they're doing. Another is that they're not the right, so they're not the right audience. You should be reaching people who don't know the truth. Tell them. Furthermore, you shouldn't be telling them. It's not that we have some, you know, whoever it is, has some kind of magic authority. We have our own ideas. They have their ideas. In 1975, for example, the large majority of Americans, I think, knew the truth, that the war was not a mistake. It was fundamentally wrong and immoral. You didn't have to tell them the truth. You can participate with them in finding out the truth, learning it yourself, encouraging them to think it through for themselves. So you should be reaching out to other people, trying to learn the truth as best you can together with them. And it should be the audience that matters, not the powerful. And it should be on issues that are of significance. So I think a somewhat more complex version of that precept ought to be adopted. But the intuition behind it is right, and I think it's a sensible guide. And from that we can kind of work out what the responsibility of intellectuals ought to be, comparing it with what the function actually is, and drawing appropriate conclusions. I'll stop there.
How can we be heard so long as we're nobody yet, unknown, economically dependent, and supposed to get somewhere?
Is this working? Yeah. Well, first of all, nobody is nobody. And if you want to have, there are very good models as to what young people can do. They've achieved a great deal. So let's go back, say, 50 years and go to North Carolina in the United States or Georgia in the United States. At that point, young people who were facing far harsher difficulties than you are, young black kids, decided to sit in on restaurants, to insist on being waited in restaurants, which was illegal for blacks at the time. So a small group of young kids, college students, went and sat in at a bar in a diner. The police came, took them out, threw them in jail. I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant. The next day, more came back and did it again. After a couple of years, it ended up really revolutionizing the country. That's what's one of the things that sparked the civil rights movement. They were at a lot of them were at Spelman College, a black college. They had virtually no support from the faculty. Two faculty members supported them, both were thrown out. One was Howard Zinn, who you may know, my old friend who died 2 years ago. He was a faculty member. He supported the students. He was expelled. The students themselves went on. A lot of them joined the group that became the Freedom Riders. At that point, some white students from the North came down to join them. They rode in buses through the South trying to register blacks that couldn't register then. It wasn't easy. Several of them got murdered. Others were beaten, thrown into prisons. I was down there for demonstrations, and you could see, watching while state police were beating people, young kids mostly, driving them up the... They were fleeing to the steps of the federal building where the state police are not allowed to go. And the federal building was lined with federal marshals sent from Washington who were throwing them back into the streets. That's the way the government was protecting them. They achieved a great deal. Martin Luther King, who was an extremely important person, would have been the first to tell you that he was riding the groundswell that they developed. And that's by no means the only case. Take my own university, MIT. MIT was practically 100% funded by the Pentagon, which, contrary to what a lot of people believe, means it was extremely free. The Pentagon didn't care what you did. They wanted to create the economy of the future. That was their job. It's highly undemocratic. They were using public resources on the, not they, the government, used public resources on the pretext of defense to develop computers, the internet, microelectronics, and so on. That's the way the high-tech economy developed. But it was a very passive place, very passive, acquiescent, people doing their work, not paying much attention to anything. There were about five students who decided to try to stir the place up. Some of them you may know. One was Michael Albert, who now runs ZNet. Another was Steve Shalom, who's Pete Boehmer, a couple others. And they just kind of began organizing groups around the campus. By 1968, they had so radicalized the campus that Mike Albert was elected student president on a platform so radical you can barely believe it. Well, he was thrown out. We had to get him back in. Usual things happen. But the point is that the university's never been the same to this day. Now it's active, a lot of participation, totally different relationships among people, and it's a center of activism. And the things like that happen all the time. There's a tremendous amount that young people can do. In fact, if you look at take Tahrir Square in Cairo. That was mostly organized by fairly young people, I guess in their 20s mostly, tech-savvy, began reaching out to others. They didn't really expect much at the beginning, but they, within a couple of weeks, they had half of Egypt out there, and they overthrew a dictatorship. They got a long way to go, but it was a major event, again, initiated by young people who were committed and active. And there are plenty of other examples. You can be heard, all right.
In linguistics, you have wondered whether language is an optimal solution. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is an optimal solution in politics as well? Or should we sometimes accept the least bad option?
Well, if there is an optimal solution, I'm not smart enough to figure out what it is. There's just too much we don't know about human beings and about societies. A lot would have to be learned by experimentation, trying things, see if they work, try other things, and so on. And in fact, this is a pretty traditional view on the left. So say, take Karl Marx. You read through all of his works, you find practically nothing on post-capitalist society. A couple of sentences scattered around here and there. So in a post-capitalist society, you know, everyone would fish in the morning and grow his garden in the afternoon, a couple of lines like that. And there was a reason for it. He believed in workers' democracy. His conception was that there would be a popular revolution, working people would take control of their own fate and their own institutions, and then they would work out what the society ought to be like. He didn't have a prescription. He had some ideas about general principles, but not a description. On the other hand, there were people on the left, still are, Mike Albert, who I mentioned is one, who think that you can give a very detailed account of what a future society ought to be like. And they've worked out, detailed proposals, which you could try out right now, even in within the present society. Well, you know, between these two extremes, there are lots of approaches that people have taken, and you have to decide how much you think you understand. I don't think I understand very much, so I don't feel I'm more on Marx's side. I think these things will have to be worked out. I doubt that there's anything that you could call an optimal solution. People are just too different. They live in too many different ways. There are probably many possible peaks that can be approached, and life will be a lot more interesting if there's diversity in outcomes.
How come we live in an open society with a lot of information, and yet we know so little? How come we live in an open society with a lot of information, yet we know so little?
Actually, I add a little personal touch. About 25 years ago, I was asked by a publisher to write a book. It finally came out with a different publisher called Knowledge of Language. Now, the reason it came out with a different publisher was because I included in the book one chapter that the original publisher refused to publish. It was about, in part, about this question. Most of the book was about what I called Plato's problem, the problem of how we know so much with so little information. The last chapter was about something I called Orwell's problem, this one. How come we know so little with so much information? So those are the last, and then I went on and gave the reasons. It's not very profound. The publisher wasn't going to allow that, so we got to know little. But the answer is straightforward. It's the kind of thing I was talking about. I mean, there are concerted efforts to make sure that you know very little and understand very little, which is even more important, even with so much information about. So when you go to school, you don't read about the first 9/11. You don't read about Reagan's war on terror. You do read about Solzhenitsyn and Havel and others, and about our courage in supporting them, but you don't read about the Jesuit intellectuals, or the war against the church, or the effort to destroy the attempt to bring back the Christianity of the Gospels. I mean, those are things you just don't read about. They're there. You can find them. We live in open societies. You can go to the library. You can get the information about them. But it's a research project, and that's conscious. Partly it's internalized by educated people. You're kind of brought up that way yourself, so that's the way you see things, and it's more convenient, and so on. And if you break out of the mold, there are difficulties. In our societies like ours, the difficulties aren't very severe, but they're there. And it's easier not to face difficulties. It's easier to come to believe what it's convenient to believe. So these various factors, some quite conscious, others just sort of normal human reactions, and lead to a situation in which there's tons of information out there, but you don't know it. Or if you know it, you don't understand it.
Several people are asking you to express your opinion on the WikiLeaks.
Well, the WikiLeaks, I'm often asked, do I think Julian Assange was a hero or a devil? I don't think either. I think it's just a person doing a civic responsibility. It's a civic responsibility to help people know and understand what power systems are up to. They don't like it, of course, no matter what power system it is. They'd rather have their workings be secret from the public. But what right do they have to keep their workings secret from the public? Technically, they're supposed to be our representatives. We should know everything they're doing. I mean, you can imagine there might be some cases in which information has to be kept, there's an argument for keeping information secret. But you have to make the argument. The burden of proof is always on a power system that says this has to be secret. Maybe sometimes they can meet it. So, for example, take the Pentagon Papers, which were a very rich store of information. Dan Ellsberg, who released them, did keep one volume. He did not. There was one volume he didn't give to the press. I was one of the people who distributed the papers, a couple of the friends of his. So we had the volume. I was able to read it, but we didn't give it to the press. I wasn't convinced that that was necessary, but made some sense. The volume was about negotiations, and there were ongoing negotiations. So if he took the negotiations seriously, and frankly I didn't, then it would have, there's an argument for not releasing it. It might disrupt the negotiations. But an argument has to be given. And it's very rare that that burden can be met. It's kind of like the burden that has to be met by any authoritarian or hierarchic institution. It has to justify itself. It's not self-justifying. You take a look at the WikiLeaks. I can't think of anything there that there would be any argument to have suppressed. And there's a lot of interesting material, very interesting. Maybe the most interesting material, at least to me, is what it tells us, what the WikiLeaks tell us, not about governments, but about our own intellectual communities, the communities that we live in, the educated sectors, you know, the cultural elite, if you like, the press and so on. And what it revealed is extremely interesting. And it's even more interesting that it hasn't been noticed. It's pretty transparent. I suppose the Dutch press was much like the English language press. In the English language press, it got the most attention, you know, big headlines and everything, was that the Arabs support us on Iran, crucial issue. And a lot of excitement, you know, this shows, you know, how we're doing the right thing. Even the Arabs support us, strongly support us. Well, take a look at what came out in WikiLeaks about that. What came out was statements by Arab dictators. They allegedly support us. But what about the Arab population? Actually, there's a lot known about Arab public opinion. It's not reported, at least in English. Maybe it was reported here. I doubt it. But a lot is known about Arab public opinion. There are recent polls taken by the most prestigious U.S. Polling organizations released by major institutions, Brookings Institute in Washington, others. And what they say is quite interesting. They, for example, in Egypt, 90% of the public think their worst enemy is the United States. The figures are pretty similar for the whole region, United States and Israel, which are regarded correctly as about the same thing. So, you know, on the order of 80-90% throughout the region say that's the main threat. And what about Iran? 10% think Iran is a threat. In fact, support for Iran hatred for Western policy is so extreme that a large majority think that the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. In Egypt, 80%. You know. Well, you know, the Arabs support us. Yeah, the Arab dictators. What matters to the editorial writers and the commentators and the public intellectuals and so on is that the dictators support us. If the population strongly opposes us, who cares? As long as they're quiet. As long as you can keep them under control, who cares? Now that reveals an attitude towards democracy which is extremely significant. It indicates pretty strikingly the extent to which democracy is absolutely hated by educated sectors, sectors that have any connection to power or privilege. And it's very relevant to... Incidentally, this is not the first time this has been true. This has been true for decades, and there's plenty of evidence about it. But again, it's not what you're likely to be taught in school or reading the newspapers and so on. But you can find it out, and you've learned something about yourselves. That's really important. Knowing yourself is quite important. That's why that bad guy drank the hemlock. Thanks.
What is the role of intellectual critique in a society like Holland, where critique and not positive policy making is the standard?
Where?
What is the role of intellectual critique
and
in
critique
a society?
Critique and not positive. Well,
there's a continuation.
I see.
Should intellectuals take on a more positive role in making neat plans that can be implemented in practice instead of a critical approach?
Well, taking the last part, I don't see why there's a distinction. Taking a critical approach just in order to criticize is, makes you feel good, but no point. Taking a critical approach because you want to see policy changes, that makes good sense. So go back to, say, the prophets. When they were giving a critical analysis of the deeds of the, evil kings, they were calling for a change in policies and attitudes. And that's what critical people ought to be doing, critical intellectuals, if you like. What was the first point?
What is the role of, of an intellectual critique in a society where critique is the
not,
standard?
Yeah, change the society. It doesn't work like that.
You get some.
Yeah, thanks.
You said, don't speak truth to powers, they'll know it already. How do you explain they don't act on this truth?
Don't speak truth to powers. Oh, they do. I mean, how the powerful... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What you argue for is reasonable, very reasonable to any human being. How come people in power don't act on it? Are they all corrupted by power, immoral, perhaps amoral?
Well, they may be whatever they are. That's, for their families and psychiatrists to worry about. But they're in institutions. When you're an institution and you play a role in that institution, there are some limits on what you can do. So let's take a couple of, I think, concrete examples are good to think about instead of abstract discussion. We're in the middle of a huge fiscal crisis, economic crisis. Where did that come from? Well, to a large extent, it came from a basic principle of market systems, which is an unavoidable property of market systems. Namely, if you're, suppose you sell a car to somebody, if you're paying attention, you carry out that transaction so that you make out reasonably well and the other person does too. But there's some things you don't consider. Like you don't consider the effect on her, see. That's called an externality if you've studied economic theory. The effect of a transaction on others is something you don't consider in market systems, right? And there is an effect. Like if you buy a car, there's more pollution, there's more congestion, a lot of things that affect other people. But those are externalities. You don't care about them. Well, in financial systems, there's a big externality, which is well understood. It's called systemic risk. Systemic risk is the risk that the whole system will crash. Okay? So if, say, Goldman Sachs makes a transaction which they will, if they're doing their job, they'll cover the risk to themselves, right? They'll take that into account. They won't take into account the risk that the whole system will crash. That's an externality. Well, that externality happens to have big effects, like crashing the system repeatedly. Ever since during the 50s and the 60s, there weren't any financial crashes because there were regulations in place. In the 70s on to the 80s and 90s, the regulatory apparatus has been dismantled. As a result, systemic risk is always ever present, and you have repeated financial crises. Well, these financial crises, these are pretty bad crises. And the financial crisis leads to a general economic crisis. So people don't have jobs. In the United States now, probably 20% of the population qualifies for food stamps because they just can't get food. It is pretty serious. But for the rich and the powerful, it doesn't matter because this comes back to talking truth to power. They may preach market systems, but they don't believe in them. What they believe in is a powerful nanny state that works for them. Not for anyone else, but it works for them. So if the system crashes, say Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and Barclays Banks and the rest of them, if they crash the system as they just did, they have a solution. Run to the nanny state, holding your copy of Hayek and so on, and tell them to bail you out, meaning the taxpayer to bail you out, which is what happens. That's a government insurance policy. It's called too big to fail. It means if you crash the system, you just come and say, look, I'm too big to fail, bail me out. And the taxpayer dutifully bails them out. Right now, they're richer than ever. If you're following what's happening in the United States, there are huge protests all over the country, in Wisconsin and elsewhere, and people are in real trouble. At the same moment, they're cutting back collective bargaining, pensions, they want to cut Social Security, everything's got to be cut, like here. Meanwhile, at the very same moment, the people who caused the crisis are giving themselves fabulous bonuses. Goldman Sachs just quietly, and they're the worst of them, announced $17.5 billion in bonuses for management, $12.5 million just for the CEO, triple his salary and so on. Now, that's happening right at the moment when there's real suffering around the country. The same as I just happen to be in England. There's a front-page story every day about the bankers who gave themselves a massive bonus. Probably the same is happening here. So that's an externality. You don't pay attention to it. Now, let's go back to the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Is he a bad person? No, I don't care one way or another whether he's a good person or a bad person. Like I say, that's a problem for his family. But the role that he plays forces this decision, literally. If he decides, I'm not going to make that decision, he's out, and somebody else is in who will make it, because that's a property of the semi-market system that he's participating in. Now, in that case, there's somebody around to bail you out when everything crashes, but there's another case, quite a critical one, in fact, a lethal one, where externalities are ignored and necessarily ignored, and it'll probably destroy the species. Now, that's the environmental crisis. The business world does not want to do anything to deal with the environmental crisis for good reasons. It harms their short-term profit. Now, suppose you're the CEO, chairman of some major corporation in the United States. Your task is to maximize short-term profit and market share, period. If you don't do that, you're out and somebody else is in. In fact, in Anglo-American law, it's a legal requirement. But quite apart from that, you just have to do it or you're just not in that position anymore. It's a crime of the position, not of the individual. That means you've got to ignore externalities. In this case, the externality is the fate of the species. It means you have to try to convince people, you have to run big propaganda campaigns to convince people that global warming is a liberal hoax and so on, which is exactly what's being done. It's quite effective. I don't know what it is here, but in the United States, maybe about a third of the population thinks it's a serious problem at this point. And you take a look at the new Republican Congress, just about every one who came in is a climate denier. It's all a liberal hoax. We don't want to do anything. They're already cutting down funding, not only for U.S. programs, but even for the International Scientists Organization, been defunded. They don't want to do anything about it because the fate of the species is an externality. And if you're working in a market system, you don't pay attention to it. Well, in this case, there's no taxpayer to bail you out. Once you destroy the possibilities of decent human survival, kiss each other goodbye. And that's where we are right now. This is not an abstract consideration. It's happening right before our eyes, right before our eyes. Now, those are serious problems, and it doesn't make sense to ask, is that person good or bad? There's an institutional structure which is lethal, harmful in the case of, say, financial institutions, but not lethal. Lethal in this case, and that's not the only one.
Can there be a society without organized violence? For instance, wars, civil war, dictatorship. What do you think the ideal world would look like?
Well, that was actually a question raised by two great 20th century figures, Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein, and they came out in 1955 with a memorandum, a kind of a statement to the people of the world, a declaration to the people of the world. It was about nuclear war. That's another case like global warming. It could be and probably will be the destruction of the species. Their declaration told, I forget the exact words, but it was exactly this. They said to the people of the world, you're facing a choice that is stark and unavoidable. Either mankind will abandon war or the species is finished. That's their conclusion, and I think it's plausible. There just can't be any more major wars. I mean, it takes, say, Europe. Europe for centuries was the most savage, brutal place in the world. The Europeans spent most of their time and creative energy and activity in figuring out ways to slaughter each other. That went on for centuries. Europe, in fact, created a technology and a culture of savagery and barbarism which is so extreme that they could conquer the rest of the world. I mean, if you look at the conflicts between Europe and, you know, India, you know, Mexico and so on, Europe always conquered the enemy, but by savagery. In fact, you look at, read military historians, what they say is that for most of the world, war was a kind of a sport. For Europe, it was a science, and it won. You know, so small groups of Europeans could massacre huge numbers of what they called barbarians, people who didn't think that war was a science. Well, that's the core part of European history, up to 1945. Not since. Did genes change? No change in the genes. What happened is that Europeans finally realized that the next time they play their favorite game of slaughtering each other, it's all going to be over. You can't do it anymore. The level of savagery and violence has reached a point where you just can't make use of it, so something has to be done to cut it back. So, yeah, that's an answer. It's not necessary in human nature. I mean, you know, unless these forces are constrained, they'll blow up. They can be constrained, so the chances of a major war inside Europe are very slight, which is a huge change from centuries of history.
Mr. Chomsky says that we should address the right audience, but he also says that people in power try to make dissidents be ignored in the least. In the light of this, what would be the most practical or efficient way to go about addressing the audience and trying to be heard by them?
That depends where you are. if you were, say, in El Salvador, there wasn't really an answer to that because you're going to get your brains blown out, which is what happened. If you're in, say, Turkey, which is a moderately repressive society, you know, pretty free, but not entirely, probably what they're doing is the best way. A constant protest, civil disobedience, and so on. I mean, I've been in Turkey a number of times over the past 10 years and have actually participated in some of these civil disobedience actions. I was there a couple months ago, and it was a major conference on freedom of speech. And the participants, mostly Turkish, were journalists, artists, academics, and others, describing the activities that they're involved in, which are very courageous. A lot of them are working on Armenian rights and trying to bring about the recognition of the Armenian genocide and the repression of Armenian sins. And most of them are working on Kurdish rights. That's the big issue. And extremely brutal in the 1990s. It's been improving some since, but still going on. Well, you know, that's the best method for them, facing real problems. The best method for people like us is much easier. We have very limited constraints. I mean, enough freedom has been won in societies like ours so that you know, it's not perfect and you're not going to get lauded, but there's a wide range of opportunity to do all kinds of things without suffering the kinds of severe penalties that only saints are willing to endure.
One final question. Okay. Is it possible to be well-intentioned while committing atrocities? If so, should these good intentions change our assessment of these atrocities?
I think it's not only possible to be well-intentioned, at least by self-perception, while committing atrocities, but it's almost universal. You just take a look at the record of major criminals. You know, I mean, I'm talking about people like Hitler and Stalin and the rest of them. Not just sort of garden variety atrocities, but, I mean, world-shaking ones. You take a look at the record, it's being done with the utmost nobility. I mean, Hitler invaded Poland to protect Germany from what he called the wild terror of the Poles. The Germans had no choice. You know, the Poles were terrorizing them. They had to defend themselves. Slaughtering the Jews was saving the purity of the of civilization. Hitler didn't talk about it much, but people like Martin Heidegger did. I remember, you know, I was kind of surprised when, in recent years, there was kind of discussion of the discovery that Heidegger had been a Nazi. I mean, I started reading him in the 1950s. You read, take a look at Introduction to Metaphysics, you know, you get in 20 pages. He's talking about how it's the task of Germany to save civilization, which comes from the Greeks to the Teutons. The Germans are the inheritors. And they have to protect it from the barbarians of the East and West, you know. And corrupt elements have to be eliminated and so on. So we can... What can be more noble than preserving the civilization handed to us to the Greeks? Okay, that's the Nazis. You read the Russian a lot of Russian archives have come out since 1990, and they're pretty interesting reading. I mean, you take a look at the internal discussions. You know, Gromyko talking to Molotov and all this business, talking to each other, not trying to impress anyone. Now, they're talking about the need to defend democracy, people's democracies, from Western fascists. And that's why you had to control and prevent anything from happening in Eastern Europe. You know, again, perfectly noble. And in fact, it's very rare to find anyone who says, I'm carrying out terrible crimes because I want to. You know, maybe there are people like that, but I think almost always you find a way to justify it. And I suspect if you look at your own experiences, you'll find plenty of things like that. Like maybe when you were, you know, 6 years old and your mother wasn't looking, you took a toy from your younger brother or something, and he went and ran and complained to your mother, and she came to see what's going on, and you said, I didn't do anything. He gave it to me. He didn't want it. It was mine anyway, and so on and so forth. You find a way to justify what you're doing, and you believe it. You really believe it. You convince yourself of it. And I think that's probably true quite generally. I think, not nice maybe, but I think it's probably true.
I'm going to commit a well-justified, abominable atrocity and conclude this discussion.
I would like to thank you, Noam Chomsky, for coming here, for giving your lecture, for telling us about your intellectual life, for giving us an example of how an academic, how an intellectual could act in this strange but nevertheless very beautiful society. Let me remind you of one fact before I close down and we go to coffee. The building we are in is an Armenian church, not an Armenian, but an Arminian church, which means it is the church for a branch of Dutch Reformed people who are tolerant in every way. And I think that's a very appropriate place to have you had your speech here. I wish you a very good stay here in Utrecht and hope to meet you soon.